You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking, on with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Ian, and with me are my comrades and co-hosts Tracy.
Hello.
And Colin.
Hello.
Each episode we'll be talking about bands that begin with a different letter of the alphabet. We'll be talking about a big band and a lesser known band.
Not a big band as in like the jazz sort.
No. Because they don't have those kind of names.
No.
Really, do they?
Well, Glenn Miller.
Band.
Glenn Miller Band.
Glenn Miller's Gland.
Talk about
that.
Won't be talking about that. Anyway.
So, and this week we're on L.
We are.
And we are talking about Jenny Lewis, who was also in Rilo Kiley.
Yes, so we'll be talking about them as well.
And Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin. You didn't forget that, did you?
Yes, I did.
Excellent.
A band whose one drum beat has been sampled by every motherfucker in the world.
This is true. But we'll get onto that in a bit.
Yes. Cool.
So, we'll start off with talking about Jenny Lewis.
Yes, let's do that.
Is an LA-based singer-songwriter who started out as a child actor before forming Rilo Kiley, an indie rock band with her boyfriend at the time, fellow child actor Blake Sennett, in 1998.
What did they act in?
They acted in lots of different
things. Loads of things.
She was mostly in sort of bit parts in random things like The Golden Girls and stuff like that.
Right.
She's been in loads of adverts as well.
Yeah, I think she started out in adverts, but I think most sort of actors do. She was in a film in the 90s called Pleasantville, which I've never seen, but I think it's all like black and white and then goes colour.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It must be like The Wizard of Oz.
Or I think it might be vice versa, like someone goes into the past and it's all black and white.
That's possible. She's in that. But I don't think she was ever in anything really well known. Blake Sennett was in Boy Meets World. He was a recurring character in that. He was in a thing called Salute Your Shorts, which I think was really well known in America, but I don't think came over here.
Right.
And he was also, I found out the other day, he's in an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh.
The one where Willow and the other witch that turns herself into a rat, they're all like getting burnt at the stake, and there's a boy witch who gets burnt at the stake first, and that's Blake Sennett.
Oh. He's also got a cool name.
He has, yeah, but he's my least favourite member of Rilo Kiley. Anyway.
Where did they get the name from?
They've never disclosed where they got. They've made up loads of random.
Like Biffy
Clyro, yeah. They just make up stories every now and again, but they've never actually explained where. I think it might have been something to do with an anagram of Kylo Ren from the Star Wars movie that hadn't come out until years after they split up.
Yeah, clearly that.
Because
they
are time travellers. she released her first solo album, well, sort of solo. It was with the Watson Twins, called Rabbit Fur Coat in 2006. And then carried on with both solo career and Rilo Kiley for a few years until Rilo Kiley amicably split in 2011, so she could concentrate fully on her solo work. She's also was a member of the Postal Service with Tracy's favourite Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie. And she's also worked with Elvis Costello, Beck and Ryan Adams over the years. Rilo Kiley's where I first heard of her, as a lot of people will have done.
I honestly, in my research, my extensive research that happened for half an hour this morning, discovered that I'd heard someone playing one of Rilo Kiley's songs loads.
Okay.
You'll surely
someone
have heard.
Someone covers it at the acoustic night. And I can't remember who.
Leah sings it with Colin.
You've heard me and Leah sing it, yeah.
Yeah, see.
Portions for Foxes.
That's the one.
Yes. I got into them through Saddle Creek Records, which was a record label that I was absolutely obsessed with about 15, 16 years ago.
Yes, I remember that.
There's the most well-known band on Saddle Creek is Bright Eyes. There was also The Faint, The Good Life, Cursive, Azure Ray, and various others. And I, there was a, for their like 50th album that the label had released, they did a compilation, which is called Saddle Creek 50, where it's got songs from each of the bands on the label.
Yeah.
And so there was a Rilo Kiley, there was, each band did a new track, and there was a track off one of their albums on there. So there was a couple of Rilo Kiley tracks on there, and they were some of my favourite tracks on there, so I investigated further.
Yeah, around the time Portions for Foxes and It's a Hit were out, they were playing a lot on Six Music.
Yeah, so that's on More Adventurous, I think.
Yeah, and I was in a job then where I could actually listen to the radio all day, which was brilliant. So I heard them on there, but they never investigated any further.
Okay.
I really did like them singles.
Yeah. Well, Portions for Foxes particularly is fantastic.
Yeah, it really,
really
is.
Really good sort of pop rock.
Yeah, no, that's a great song.
And it's probably, people that don't know it very well probably know it as Bad News, because that's what they call it.
Yeah.
So the first record I got them the first record that I got by Rilo Kiley was The Execution of All Things, which was their debut on Saddle Creek. They'd already released an earlier album called Takeoffs and Landings, which was on Barsuk Records, which is the label that Death Cab for Cutie were on in the early days. And it's quite... I would recommend that Tracy does not necessarily listen to that album, because it really does remind me of Death Cab.
Right.
In quite a lot of ways. There is...
The name of that album just makes me think Elbow, though.
Yeah, but that was years later, the Takeoff and Landings of Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought of that.
Oh, right.
The plagiaristic fascist. there is one particular song on there that is really good. It's called Pictures of Success.
I listened to that on the playlist you did for this pod, yeah. And I really loved it. And I was thinking, God, why didn't I buy these albums?
You know what? You might like that album, because it's not got... It's got...
There was another one on there as well that you put on the playlist, I think that's on the same album, With Arms Outstretched.
No, that's on...
Oh, is that a different album?
That's on The Execution of All Things.
Oh, okay.
But
it's so lovely.
Well, that the first album has got sort of elements of similar sort of guitar sounds and the interweaving sort of thing that Death Cab for Cutie have got, but it's not got Ben Gibbard on it.
Well, hurrah
so
for
might,
that.
You might prefer it. It's got Jenny Lewis instead, who you do like.
Yeah.
But yeah, The Execution of All Things, basically they'd been touring around a bit, and they got invited by Conor Oberst, who is Bright Eyes and runs Saddle Creek Records, to sign up for Saddle Creek Records.
Yeah.
So there's actually a lyric in the title track on The Execution of All Things that says, we'll go to Omaha to work and exploit the booming music scene and humility. Because that's what they did. And it got me into them, so it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say I didn't investigate any further, I didn't buy any Rilo Kiley albums, but I did buy that solo Jenny Lewis one, Rabbit Fur Coat. But I don't remember listening to it much back in the day. So I revisited it last week, and I've been hooked.
It's right up your street.
It really is. It's just all kinds of sexy and sultry country and gospel stylings. I mean, particularly with the Watson Twins backing vocals.
Yeah, well, it's like close part harmonies.
Yeah, it's just stunning.
And there's definitely slices of alt Alt Country Heartbreak on there.
Definitely slices of Alt Country Heartbreak
on
there.
Alt Country Chocolate Cake, as you know, is one of Tracy's favourite elements.
But also, though, her voice made me think of Bethany from Best Coast as well.
I've got a feeling they've toured with Best Coast.
Have they? I mean, well, are they not LA-based as well, Best Coast?
I think so.
Because her voice is beautiful.
I'm sure they've toured together, possibly even collaborated at some point.
Do you know what? A connection between them is Best Coast and Jenny Lewis both have a song called Happy.
Yes.
Only that the Best Coast one is Happy, the Jenny Lewis one isn't.
It's not.
It's Country Heartbreak.
What about the Pharrell Williams one?
That is Happy. Yeah. But I mean, I like the bittersweet melancholy version.
Do you really?
Yes.
It's barely been covered.
I'm going to say, listeners, have you picked up on that at all? She keeps it very secret.
But it was weird because when I listened to that song Happy, the Jenny Lewis song, not the Pharrell or the Best Coast one, it made me think of an album that I mentioned in our introductory episode, the album that I'd been totally obsessed with, the Scud Mountain Boys,
yeah.
Massachusetts. There's a song on there called Grudgefuck. And if you play them two songs back to back, Happy almost seems like an answer to Grudgefuck. It's like a companion song.
Okay.
I've tried this theory out on a friend on Twitter. He hasn't responded in full yet. I don't know if he's actually tried it, because he's the one that got me into the Scud Mountain Boys.
It wouldn't surprise me if she was aware of Scud Mountain Boys, because Uncle Tupelo,
yes,
are well known in the alt country scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely, occasionally been on the fringes of the alt country sort of thing. She's got a lot more sort of pop elements to her sound as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, the More Adventurous was sort of their album that should have been a big hit, but obviously sales didn't translate massively on that kind of thing. That's the one with Portions for Foxes on it.
Yeah.
And
So while I love the pop elements, it's always the melancholy bits that get me. I mean, I don't know if I go looking for it or if it comes looking for me.
But Ben Gibbard's really melancholy, though.
He is.
Oh, but he's so sappy.
On another note, something else I got from the playlist, one of the tracks on there, it's like 8-9 minutes long, something new Messiah, is it?
The Next Messiah.
Next Messiah. Yeah, I got a really Nick Cave vibe from that one.
Yes.
Like, nowhere near as good as Nick Cave, but like she'd heard him.
Yes.
And thought, that sounds like something I'd like to do.
Yeah.
That's on her second solo album, Acid Tongue.
Yeah.
Which I am going to have to go and get now.
I think you'd obviously went, just to let people in on the background of how we prepare, or don't in some cases, for the podcast. we make each other a playlist, but we try and limit it to 10 tracks. And sometimes it's really, really difficult, particularly when you've got, with Jenny Lewis, I wanted to put a mixture of Rilo Kiley and Jenny Lewis stuff on there.
Limiting further.
So it limits the stuff that you can put on there. But Acid Tongue, that album, I think there's quite a few things that you'd really.
Yeah, I mean, The Next Messiah, you're right. It's got a real blues tinge to it as well, though. I mean, she can turn her hand to almost any vocal style, can't she? You know, she sort of covers pop, country, gospel,
I almost
folk.
Went the actress thing helps
maybe
that.
Maybe.
Because when you're listening to the songs, it's difficult to tell whether she's singing from personal experience or if she's playing a character. I think there's definitely a lot of the playing a character in there.
Storytelling.
Yeah, the storytelling.
Kind of like PJ Harvey does.
Yeah, but particularly when she's singing about, you know, Jack Killed Mom, which is another song on there where it's a song about someone accidentally killing an overbearing parent and stuff like that. With the storytelling side of things, there's a track on More Adventurous, which is called Does He Love You, which is, it's quite clever. If anybody doesn't like spoilers, Listen away now. You can't look away because it's a podcast.
No, just look away.
Look away. You'll still hear what I'm going to say, but, you know. That is a song where it's basically, it's written as two old friends writing to each other that have moved away, and one of them's talking about how she's, you know, everything's going right for her, you know, she's got a new husband, she's got a baby on the way and everything. And then the other one's talking about how she's not happy where she is, and it sort of switches where the other one's talking about how her husband seems distant, and she's writing about how she's got this new person that she's met. And then the twist is that she works out at the end that the friend is having an affair with her husband.
Right.
It works. It sounds corny the way I described it there, but the way it's written, that's what got Elvis Costello. He heard that track and then started every interview you read or heard with Elvis Costello for about 2 years. He had to mention Rilo Kiley, who's going on about, and then he did guest vocals on
one of the ones you put on the playlist featured Elvis Costello, because you didn't tell us that, and I was listening, I was like, but that's Elvis Costello.
It is Elvis Costello.
I mean, there's no mistake in his voice, is there?
And Jenny Lewis is also, she does guest vocals on his album called Momofuku, I think it's pronounced.
Okay.
M-O-M-O-F-U-K-U. Momofuku or something like that. I'll probably pronounce that completely wrong.
Probably.
It sound like a swear word, but...
Momofuku.
Optimus Bowie. But yeah, she sort of seemed to get a little bit more Fleetwood Mac influence as they went along, because the last Rilo Kiley album, Under the Blacklight, is very sort of Rumours sounding.
Yeah.
There's a track called Dreamworld on it, which I really like, which is unusual because it's a Blake Sennett track. Normally the tracks that Blake Sennett sings lead vocals on are the ones that I tend to skip, because he, to me, sounds like a not as good version of Elliott Smith. I like Elliott Smith, but...
But you don't want
to listen
to,
not as good version.
Didn't I say that about Ben Gibbard? A not as good version of Elliott Smith.
You read a review that called them an Elliott Smith cover band.
Yeah.
Turns out they're really good at it.
Yeah, that was it.
I know this because I spent a few hours editing the episode a few weeks ago. So, but yeah, they're really, really sort of Fleetwood Mac influence on that album. And then her last solo album, which was released after Rilo Kiley split, which is called Voyager, is basically sounds like 80s Fleetwood Mac in a lot of it.
When you say her last Rilo Kiley album was Rumours, was that in real life as well? Because she's not still with...
I think there is a bit of that in there.
Yeah.
Because her and Blake Sennett were a couple.
Yeah.
But it was a lot earlier that they split up.
Oh, right.
I think.
But maybe the songs had been written earlier.
I think they split up before More Adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. But I think that's the case. Because she's now, and since not long after that, been... her boyfriend is Jonathan Rice, who is guest vocals on The Next Messiah. He's the male vocal.
Oh, right.
When I saw her live in California, he came on and did guest vocals with her. Seriously, man, best gig I've ever been to. I'm going to mention it.
Okay.
But yeah, I should have... I've seen Rilo Kiley live twice. No, I haven't. Seen Rilo Kiley live once. I've had tickets to see Rilo Kiley live twice. The first time was on the More Adventurous tour. It was at the Social in Nottingham, which is a tiny venue, really, really, really small. Mm. At the time, I thought they should have been in a much better venue, much bigger venue. Was really, really excited, really looking forward to it. Went with my girlfriend at the time. Not going to name any names, but she was very tall, very, very, very skinny. And she decided not to eat all day. So we watched the support band, and then she started feeling really faint. And we had to leave before Rilo Kiley even came on.
Oh no.
I'm not bitter.
Not bitter at all.
Of course not.
Luckily, they toured and they played Nottingham again, Rescue Room, so bigger venue, but still not massive.
I like the Rescue Room. A
couple of years. I love the Rescue Room, but the Social would have been really, really special.
Yeah.
It's tiny. Yeah, but anyway, we're over that now. It's cool.
Yeah, definitely not still something stuck in your craw about that,
no.
Is it?
No, not at all. But yeah, throughout all of the albums, I've dug all of them. You know, there's stuff that I've liked on all of them. So,
on that Jenny Lewis album, this track.
Which one?
The rabbit fur coat, yeah. On You Are What You Love, there's an omnichord in it.
There is, yes.
Now, when I got the album back in 2006, I wouldn't have known that because I didn't have an omnichord at the time. But now I can spot an omnichord wherever it appears in music now.
And so will the listeners of this podcast, as they're going to get mentioned every time you hear one. did we describe what an omnichord is last time? I can't remember.
No, we described what a harpeggi was.
No, not in the last episode.
Last time we mentioned
it. Last time we mentioned it, there was definitely a mention of an omnichord in an earlier episode.
I'm so tired of talking about omnichords now. I'm just yawning instantly.
Okay, so an omnichord is like a synth auto harp type thing.
It's an electric auto harp. But then most people don't know what an auto harp is either.
It's an electronic auto harp. Okay. It's not an electric auto harp because that would be an auto harp with a pickup.
So basically, you push a button. And then move your hand across the thing and it strums a chord.
The sonic strings, they actually call them, on the omnichord.
Excellent.
Can you play individual ones or is it just a...
You can play individual notes, but not predictably. So it becomes rather random.
Excellent.
Nice.
But yes, there is an omnichord on there.
There is. It sounds beautiful.
I can't remember if... I don't remember if she had... I don't think she did that live when I saw her, actually, no, so there wasn't one. Perhaps if you'd have been there, you could have joined in and they could have done that song. But the Watson twins weren't there either.
Yeah, you could have just rock up and gone, I've got an omnichord, let me play.
I could have.
I imagine that some people would do that.
But you know who borrowed my omnichord, don't you?
Slayer.
Ginger from the Wildheart.
Ginger Wildheart borrowed my omnichord to do his music and words tour.
Yeah.
Was it called that, Music and Words?
I think so, something like that.
And he really didn't want to give it back.
No, because they're acts. They are a lot of fun to play with. Get an omnichord, kids.
Yeah, get an omnichord.
Yes. The dude from Minus the Bay uses one on some occasions as well.
Wow.
Excellent.
That was when I saw them at the Awkward Eye Contact gig.
The Awkward Eye Contact gig. Lots of callbacks to earlier episodes. This is good. Because if you're a new listener, go back and listen to the early ones. There's some funny bits and some bits about music that we dig or occasionally don't.
And things that we're saying now might make more sense.
Or maybe not. It may not. So on that completely rambly note of just talking rubbish, should we start talking about Led Zeppelin?
Shall we?
Good plan.
Led Zeppelin, even if you don't necessarily like them, I'd imagine there are a few people out there who don't actually know who they are. But I don't know how to describe them. I'm going to be lazy and I'm pretty much reading from a wiki page.
Who would do such a thing? Definitely not me.
So Led Zeppelin are an English rock band formed in London in 1968. The group was singer Robert Plant, guitarist Jimmy Page, bassist and keyboard player John Paul Jones,
multi-instrumentalist,
and drummer John Bonham. The band's heavy guitar-driven sound has led them to be cited as the beginning of heavy metal.
No.
But their style drew from a wide variety of influences, including blues, psychedelia, and folk music. After changing their name from the New Yardbirds, they signed a deal with Atlantic Records that afforded them considerable artistic freedom. But initially, they were rather unpopular with critics.
The critics hated them.
Yeah.
They really did get shit reviews for
yeah.
the first ages, particularly, I think particularly in the UK.
Yeah.
They were a bit better received
in the US. But they went on to have significant commercial success with their albums. So you've got the first one, Led Zeppelin, in 1969. Then Led Zepp 2, 3, 4, Houses of the Holy, Physical Graffiti. Of course, the most famous one is probably Led Zepp 4, which has Stairway to Heaven on. I'm presuming, though, like in Wayne's World, we're going to have a no stairway rule for
no.
this pod.
We're
no,
not.
Are we not?
No,
I knew you.
The
were
amount of
say
times
that.
We've gone into guitar shops over the years, and it's been a no stairway thing. Stairway is never denied here.
Yeah, and I knew you were going to say that. Stairway, yes, it's overplayed. It is. There was somebody once said that basically there was a statistic that in America, at one point, because they have their rock radio stations being really popular. Anywhere in America at any time you could tune to a radio station and hear Stairway to Heaven
mm-hmm.
at one point. I don't know if that's correct or it sounds like it might be slightly made up, but I think it's probably not much of an
but you know, as the late great Tony Wilson said, when it comes to having to choose between the truth and the legend, print the legend.
This is true.
Pantera used to finish all of their gigs with Phil Anselmo singing the last lyric to Stairway to Heaven.
I do that a bit occasionally.
I bet you've
you
never
actually.
Got hit in the face by Kirk from Crowbar suspended
That's true.
On a wire dressed as a cherub.
That is true.
Amazingly.
I've seen that happen.
I don't know how you know that that hasn't happened to me. It may have happened to me, but no.
Because I've met Kirk from Crowbar and I asked him and he said no.
Right, okay, that's fair point. Fair point, I haven't, no. But Stairway, it's overplayed because it's fucking brilliant.
Yep.
It is an absolutely amazingly crafted piece of music. It is. It's epic. It's fucking brilliant. The end section, the like sort of solo bit, is just.
It is just great.
It's brilliant. You cannot yeah. argue with Stairway.
Also, it's not the most overplayed bit of Led Zeppelin, is it?
Well, are you going to be going into samples here by any chance?
Yes, we are. Okay. Yes, we are. The drum beat to When the Levee Breaks is the most overplayed bit of Led Zeppelin. Ever.
But you don't always notice it.
No.
No. Let's reel off some songs that it's been sampled in and see if you know that it's been sampled in there.
I bet I do.
Yeah, because you've looked at it, right?
I have.
Kim by Eminem.
Are you on whosampled.com?
I knew that. I knew it was sampled in that.
Roman and Stealing by Beastie Boys.
Yep.
Yes.
To be fair, that one is very, very obvious.
Army of Me by Bjork.
Yes. I didn't know that, but I did.
I didn't know that, no.
I
love that
song. I
knew
that when I looked it up, and then when you listen to it, it's obvious.
Yep.
But the beat is slightly treated.
It's so weird, isn't it? Like Man Next Door by Massive Attack from Mezzanine.
Yeah. Whenever you need a really stompy drum beat.
Yeah.
Never Let Me Down Again by Depeche
yeah.
Mode.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, it has been sampled in 164 songs.
If you wow. think about it, it starts with drums.
Yeah.
With no guitar or bass over the top of it. And it's a really big sounding drum. So yep. it's really easy to sample because you haven't got to EQ out any other instruments. It plays a nice... The Ocean, the drum beat at the start of that's been sampled quite a lot.
Yeah.
Beastie Boys in particular. But when you do that, it's in a weird time signature. So generally, you've got to chop it up a bit.
Yeah.
Cut bits out so that you can put it back into 4/4. But when the levee breaks, it's already in 4/4, so it's nice and easy, ready-made break beat.
It is. That one and the Amen break are the two most sampled drum beats,
Funky Drummer Part 2 by James Brown also. That's you'll know that one particularly from the Hear the Drummer Get Wicked bit on the end of Bring the Noise by
yes.
Public Enemy and Anthrax.
Oh, okay.
It's used everywhere, but yeah. But the Amen break is still the most used.
Yeah.
But it's also one of the most recognisable, so you'd notice that.
So just to finish off the synopsis about Led Zeppelin anyway, they disbanded following Bonham's alcohol-related death in 1980, and they have toured again since with Jason Bonham
yeah.
taking his late father's
They've
place
not toured.
Behind the drums. Well, they have
played
live.
They've played, I think, two live gigs. They played Live Aid, and then they played the London O2 reunion in 2007, which the only reason that they did that, it was a benefit gig in memory of Ahmet Ertegun. I may have completely pronounced his name wrong, who ran Atlantic Records and basically gave them their success.
So I've got a cool story about Jason Bonham, actually.
Cool story, bro.
Friends of mine had a band in Kidderminster. We'd be talking late 80s, 88, 89-ish. And Jason Bonham offered them John Bonham's drum kit.
Cool.
They turned it down because they didn't feel it was right, and what they asked him to do instead was donate it to Kidderminster Further Education College. So that's where John Bonham's drums ended up.
I hope they auctioned it at the college to raise money for the college and didn't just let the college kids...
Let the college kids play it.
Put it somewhere.
Yeah. They could have done a lot more good for the college by auctioning it.
Perhaps, but I think it was just donated
Buy another three drum kits for the kids and have loads of extra spare money.
Yeah.
But I heard, though, that the lineup of Led Zepp could have been very different, because at one point, very early on, apparently John Entwistle and Keith Moon nearly joined the band.
They were still the New Yardbirds.
New Yardbirds, yeah.
At the time. And... basically, so Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones were basically London session musicians. Mm. So they were working. I've not got a list, but Jimmy Page is on loads of 60s pop singles.
Yeah.
I believe he actually plays some of the guitars on some of the early Kinks records, because the Kinks turned up to the studio and the producer basically went, I think we're going to get a session musician in to play the guitars on here.
Oh dear. Someone I work with told me about the Jimmy Page appearing on loads of 60s pop stuff, but I can't remember anything he told me now. And I didn't write it down. I didn't write it down. If it doesn't get written down, I forget.
Well, it's like the Yardbirds. You've got Eric Clapton was their original guitarist.
Yes, of course.
Then you've got Jeff Beck. And then you've got Jimmy Page. They're three of the, if you talk to, you know, a lot of guitarists, particularly blues orientated guitarists, they're going to be the ones that they sort of cite as being some of the best of all time.
100%.
None of them are my particular favourites myself. I'd stick Hendrix on over all three of them any day.
I like Jeff Beck, actually.
You're a big fan of Hi-Ho Silver Lining.
No, it's not really.
Actually, Truth and Beck Ola are pretty good albums, it's got to be said. Mr. James Buckingham, one of our friends, has made me listen to them years ago, and they are pretty cool. But Led Zeppelin, my introduction to Led Zeppelin really was the first CD my dad got when he first bought a CD player, was the Led Zeppelin Remasters compilation. It's basically they'd reissued the Led Zeppelin albums on CD. They were some of the first CDs that they ever did, but they used a really crappy tape transfer, and they allegedly sounded really, really crap. So they, I think they were one of the first bands to like digitally remaster their music, and it was actually, I think Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones actually went in and did the mix and master. And it was basically like a sort of best of compilation sort of thing. And I can remember sitting there when I was about eight, just listening to it on my headphones. And the track that was always one of my favourite on there, which doesn't often seem to get mentioned as people's favourite, is No Quarter.
Right.
Which is just... I think it sort of... It demonstrates why my favourite member of Led Zeppelin is John Paul Jones, because he is that track is it's like his track. He's playing electric piano put through loads of like Leslie speakers and stuff like that to get it like a swirly sort of underwater kind of sound, but he's also playing a synth bass pedal unit at the same time, so he's playing the synth bass part with his feet while he's playing this quite elaborate piano bit. The guitar parts for what Jimmy Page does is really simple, but it's got a really good groove to the riff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's dynamics in the song are absolutely amazing. It's about 7 minutes long, and it's, along with sort of Guns N' Roses, is one of the sort of things that made me really like long songs from like a fairly early age.
This is one of the songs on the first album, actually, the Lemon Song, and the bass in that, John Paul Jones' bass in that, it's just amazing.
Re-listening to it recently, I think I pick out John Paul Jones' bass playing more than... You've got, basically, obviously John Bonham died, but then you ended up in the 90s, you've got Page and Plant going out on their own.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'd rather have the other half.
They did an album...
No Quarter?
No.
Is it the one in about 99 with the blue cover? When they headlined Reading Festival, the year before I went... Well, it was 98 or 99.
No, it was in 1998, called Walking into Clarksdale.
That's the one, Walking into Clarksdale.
And produced by Steve Albini.
Yes. I didn't actually know that Albini produced that.
And recorded by Steve Albini, yes, not produced.
When Albini listens to this, I know, he's going to be pissed at you.
And what he'll do is he'll come round and he'll cover one of your favourite albums in a style that you don't like.
Or record someone else doing it, yes, while screaming over the top, "I'm not producing this."
Yes, that will happen.
And I'm not taking any points. You pay me a fee, I'm like a plumber.
I'm going to see Shellac in October, actually. I'll see if I can divert him and tell him I'm sorry.
I'm tempted.
Are you going?
I'm tempted.
That'll be loud.
Yeah, good. Oh, great. Can we add Albini to the list? We need to talk about Albini.
We should. I'm trying to mention him as often as possible in these pods.
I think we'll do some special episodes in the future based on producers.
But we could talk about Shellac, we could talk about Big Black, we could talk about Rape Man. He's done great music.
We could. But I think, no, let's do a producer's thing.
Oh, okay, cool.
That there's scope for quite a lot of different things. Sometime in the future,
Garth
there
Richardson,
will be.
I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, what with the fact that he's got three G's in it.
Is it Garth?
Or is it Garth?
Excellent.
But in the meantime, we're meant to be talking about Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know, I've mixed feelings about them. I do like them, but they push it a bit far sometimes. They push it to the extreme, and I get a bit bored, frankly, occasionally.
I get slightly narked with Robert Plant's vocals.
Do you know,
he makes a lot of sex noises.
He wails a lot. You know, occasionally, I think he sounds like Janis Joplin.
I think he's going for that. I don't think he's got a problem with that at all.
No.
I think he would fully be happy with...
Do you know that sound you get sometimes? Do they double track his vocals?
Almost certainly.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah. I don't know for definite.
It might be tape double tracking rather than actual double tracking.
Yeah.
There's definitely effects used on some of the tracks. So tape phasing is where you've got two tapes running at the same time and you slow one down slightly, which is how phasers.
Yep.
Which is kind of like a swirly sort of... sort of noise.
Yeah.
Sound like a coffee percolator then.
Yeah. Not like a phaser at all.
No.
Maybe you could put phase on your vocals while you're talking about it.
I could, but that would be far too much effort.
Well,
no, you can do that in Audacity.
Yeah, look, really easily. So hang on, I'm just going to go... And then afterwards you phase that.
That section, when I do the edit, that will have phase on it. And
excellent.
This section will have delay.
Delay.
Delay. Delay. Delay. Anyway...
We're wigging just like Zeppelin.
We are. Yeah. This is the thing. We did King Crimson in the last episode.
Yep.
When King Crimson wig out and go improvisational and just go off all over the place, I find it a lot more listenable sometimes than Zeppelin doing it. Which makes little sense to me. It's almost like in an earlier episode where Tracy was saying how she liked Depeche Mode when they had the gospel bits, but didn't like Elbow when they had the gospel bits for the same reason. I was listening to How the West Was Won, which was an album of Led Zeppelin live in 1974, but it was released
Isn't that the name of Peter Perrett's new album?
It might be, I can't remember. I've not heard it yet. I've heard very good things.
I haven't heard it yet, it's on my list.
I support it.
Sorry.
Anyway, I was listening to How the West Was Won at work the other day, and Moby Dick came on, which, at the best of times, isn't a particularly brilliant one to listen to, because it's John Bonham just doing a drum solo on his own.
Yeah.
The version on How the West Was Won is about half an hour long.
Jesus.
So about 18 minutes into it, I got bored and put the new Kesha album on because it had come out that morning. And I listened to that album 3 times in a row because the new Kesha album is fucking brilliant. But
see,
anyway.
Led Zepp 2, I mean, there's oh, I forget which track. There's one, there's got a 5-minute drum solo. On a studio album.
That's
Why?
Moby Dick.
Why?
That is Moby Dick.
Right.
But it was a thing that happened a lot in
there's
the
no need.
Because I think at the time they were trying to translate their live show to the records.
Yeah. There's no need to do it live either.
But you've got Black Sabbath did it with Rat Salad on Paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's part of trying to translate the live show, but it's also part of this is our second record. We haven't quite got enough material. Let's stick a drum solo in there. Because that's Led Zeppelin 2 and Paranoid. They're both second albums that came out around about the same time. Led Zeppelin 2 was 68, 69.
Paranoid, the title Paranoid track, was written as a filler, wasn't it?
It was.
It was like, oh, shit.
Really?
We've got to put another song on there. Just do something.
Yeah. And it became the most well-known
song. I love that song. I was listening to that last night, actually.
This is why I was never too beat up that I didn't go to the last gig, because I knew they were going to finish on Paranoid. Yeah. I think that's a massive anti-climax. It's a good song, but it's no Iron Man.
Yeah.
It's no Black Sabbath. Like, if they finished on Black Sabbath, that would be the fucking way to sorry, I've diverged.
No, that's fine. I'm just trying to save that for another day when we may speak about Black Sabbath.
It's the next album, though, Led Zepp 3, when I actually do start to... They start to click with me, because it's the folk album.
The folk one,
The folk album.
But it's also, at the same time, it opens with Immigrant Song, which is heavy and awesome.
Yes.
But it's short. But it's short.
Which is great.
But you know, it's got a pedal steel working, it's weaving its way all the way through B-side.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful.
Which I think was John Paul Jones again.
Almost.
Probably.
I would imagine it was, yeah. It could.
Could have been.
Could have been.
It is guitar. They do usually.
Yeah.
Be like, what, that says guitar. I know it's very different, but it says guitar, okay. So.
I don't know. It could have been Magical Elves playing it. That's the one that they recorded in Wales.
They'd have sung about that if it was. or maybe just Hobbits.
Or, I don't know, it depends if someone else wrote it.
Yeah, I mean, there's all the Tolkien references going through that album as well.
For the first few Led Zeppelin albums, you can almost split the lyrics in half. There's either songs that were written when they just read Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit.
Yeah.
Or there's lyrics that they stole from old blues songs.
Yes.
They did. It's almost like an early form of sampling, the way they stole the lyrics, which I suppose is karma for later on. They just got sampled all the time.
Yeah,
it's passing it on further, you know.
Mm.
I always used to think that my favourite Led Zeppelin album was House of the Holy, because it's got some of my favourite Led Zeppelin tracks on there. But it's also got some of my least favourite ones on there. Because it's got the crunge on it.
I don't know that one.
Is basically Led Zeppelin trying to do funk.
Jesus.
But in, I think it's in 5/4.
Oh, Christ.
So it's funk in an odd time signature, which doesn't work.
No, that
and
sounds horrible.
And it's also got some of the worst synthesizer sounds I've ever heard. They're just really, really bad. And on that same album, you've also got the track that everybody calls Diamaica, which is pronounced Jamaica, because it's a reggae song, but it is the whitest reggae. It's whiter than UB40.
Wow,
shit.
That's pretty fucking white.
Sorry. It's whiter than mid-period to late UB40. The first
when they started doing just covers.
Yeah, the first UB40 record is pretty good, signing off.
That the one we
when they started out. Trashing
no,
the
that was later.
It's good because you know none of them had ever been to Jamaica.
That doesn't surprise me. They're from Birmingham.
Yes. But they thought they'd just trash the Trojan back catalogue.
Although we probably shouldn't be too horrible about that album, as it was produced by someone we know.
Who also
yes,
has a
of course.
Led Zeppelin-related story.
Does he?
Does he?
So this is Alan Caves, the yes, excellent producer.
He was doing a session with some other guy producing. He was just engineering. He went to the pub with him afterwards, after spending a whole day just chatting to him, just calling him John. Paul Jones.
Right.
Didn't know. just like, you'd think it's the, but he's there's no side on him, Alan. He doesn't get starstruck. He doesn't really give a fuck. He's just like, I like you or I don't like you, and that's it. So
that's great. I walked past John Paul Jones at Glastonbury a few years ago. He was playing with C6 Steve at the time. But again, I didn't notice him at first. He walked past with C6 Steve, and I recognised C6 Steve straight away.
Yeah.
And then afterwards thought about it, and I was like, that was John Paul Jones with him.
Wow.
Shit.
So, I mean, I used to think that Led Zepp 4 was my favourite, because that's got the classics on.
I think it is my favourite overall.
But, I mean, Black Dog, that's got an amazing riff, but a friend, someone I used to work with about 15 years ago, had it as a ringtone. And when that punctuates your day, every 10 fucking minutes for years, you get a bit bored of it, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. But Led Zeppelin 4, on vinyl, that album is just one of the greatest sounds ever recorded. The whole thing is great. The mix, because it's almost like a distillation of the earlier stuff, because you've got the hard rock, blues kind of stuff of the first two records mixed with the more acoustic kind of things on Led Zepp 3.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the same song. And it's definitely the most consistent of their albums. And
I think Led Zepp 3's overtaken it in my affections now, though. Okay. Now that, because that was the record before this recording was the first time I'd actually listened to Led Zepp 3 in its entirety.
Okay.
And I don't know why, I'd never listened to the whole album before.
Well, I always thought that would be the one you would like.
Yeah.
You've got things like Tangerine on there.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, weirdly, I originally heard that song by, there was a New York hardcore-y type
Life
band
of
called
Agony.
Life of Agony, who had on their, basically they went a bit less hardcore on their third album, Soul Searching Sun. And there was a song called Tangerine on it, not a Led Zeppelin song.
No, it's a great song, though.
Yeah, really good. But then on the bonus tracks on the album, they'd got a cover of Tangerine.
Oh, that's weird.
Which also included the weird false start guitar bit at the start, where they just covered the entire thing. So that was the first time I heard that song, and then I got Led Zeppelin 3 later on. Because I already knew that song, and because it got Immigrant Song on it.
Yeah.
And that Bronny, I don't know how you pronounce that, Bronny Hour? Bronny Hour?
I've always pronounced it Bronny Hour, but as we know, I'm not the authority
no.
on how to pronounce
it. No, but
that.
I mean, when the folk blues on that, tell you what, Jack White would have killed to have written that song.
Yeah, I could see that. But the thing is, I think Jack White would have killed to be Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the whole blues influence of everything that he's ever done.
Absolutely.
He's totally taken wholesale.
Use of tiny little guitar amps as well.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can overdrive. If you get a valve amp that's a low-powered valve amp, you can whack it up full, get the valves heated up.
Saturated.
It will give you the best sort of overdrive tone from a valve amp.
Odd, though, given how influenced he was by Led Zepp, that he chose to have such a rubbish drummer.
Yep.
Well, she was his sister slash wife, so...
Yeah.
Is there...
Have we ever...
Is there ever an explanation for that? Is she...
Which? I still don't know which.
I think she's his ex-wife.
Ah.
I mean, I've seen a scan on the internet of the marriage certificate, but, I mean, of course, that could be easily faked.
The other reason why I sort of blow a bit hot and cold with Led Zeppelin is... Now... I used to think it was all really cool, the sort of rock and roll debauchery kind of thing. I've read Hammer of the Gods a couple of times, which is a classic biography of them. It was written in the early 80s, I think. But when you actually sort of look more into it, they were horrible, horrible people. There was a lot of serious fucking mistreatment going on of like groupies and things like that. Jimmy Page had a really well-documented relationship with a 14-year-old girl, which how that's not...
come to the attention bigger. Of Operation U-Tree. Yeah,
exactly. It's like, you know, you've got other people that are completely pilloried for that kind of thing, yet he appears to be sort of left to get... You know, him and Bill Wyman seem to have been left.
Yeah.
And Townsend.
Yeah, different.
With his research.
No, I can... I think that's different with Townsend. We'll get into that another time.
Yeah.
The whole... I mean, if you read Hammer of the Gods, you've got things like their... There's like their various members of their crew reporting stuff like John Bonham attempting to rape groupies and having to be pulled off by... Having to be... removed from just
poor,
not the right
poor,
working
poor
at all
choice of words.
No, pulled off was not I mean that would stop him.
Yeah, admittedly.
Look, if I pull you off, will you stop that?
If it stops someone getting raped, I'll make the sacrifice.
Yeah, and I'll take the hit.
Anyway, I think I got exposed to Led Zeppelin loads because
not in that way.
A friend of mine was in a Led Zepp tribute band called Let's Zepp.
Right.
They were actually asked to be part of the Led Zeppelin project in New Zealand. They performed with the Auckland Philharmonic Orchestra. This was in 2007. And the Led Zepp singer, Billy, was asked to join as, you know, the featured singer for it. And apparently Led Zeppelin's management thought he was so convincing, they thought it was Robert Plant himself. I've seen them live loads. They're very authentic. Way better than, you know, the tribute bands like Fred Zeppelin or Dread Zeppelin.
Dread Zeppelin? But they do reggae versions and they have a guy dressed as Elvis as the singer.
Yeah, they can't possibly be authentic.
But it does sound very, very entertaining.
Yes.
But I fear we'd go off on a hasty Dixie tangent if we started talking about them.
Almost certainly.
So, anything more to say particularly about Led Zeppelin?
Not really.
Brilliant music. Really. Probably not the nicest of people.
Possibly caused the proliferation of that double neck Gibson SG as well.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Many people that do not need to have that have got that.
They've not... Well, if you've got a song that has a 12-string bit and then a 6-string bit, it's very useful,
I guess.
Page did the thing, the plainer guitar with the violin bow as well, didn't he? Which
yes, he
has been
so,
picked
maybe
up by...
he's responsible for Sigur Rós, in which case, stellar work, Mr. Page.
Or Sigur Rós, which is one that I can actually pronounce correctly, I think.
Really?
I could be wrong.
Sigur Rós.
There was a band in the late 80s.
I'm sure it's Sigur Rós. Again, this could be a buoy.
There was a band in the late 80s, the Wildflowers, used to use that technique, playing guitar with...
I've tried it occasionally, but it's really difficult to get it sounding any good. I may try it.
Ebow is probably far easier.
Totally different thing.
Yeah.
When we had a violinist in the band, I would borrow her bow regularly to try and get it to work.
For my new band, I could do with a double neck guitar that's got an electric 12 string neck and a bass 6 neck. Because I do swap between them in one song. But
it sounds horrendous.
Yeah, stop being such a fucking tit.
But anyway, I think that's about it. So next time, we will be talking about... Can't tell that I'm having to look this up, can you? It's the letter M next time. I had to look up what the next letter was, not what the bands were, because obviously I knew all that. I just can't remember the alphabet. It's the letter M, so we'll be talking about My Bloody Valentine.
Wonderful.
And Massive Attack.
And Mastodon.
Not Mastodon.
Metallica.
No, not this time.
Magnum.
Magnum.
Bob Catlin. Tamworth Legend.
Tamworth Represent.
Standing
Sir
there
Bob.
With the wind blowing in his hair even when there's no wind. So I think we're done pretty much for that one.
Yep.
We'll see you next time. This has been Weedig Music. Bye.
Bye. But it's short.
Ah!